I think 23. Everyone says that Revelation 11 is the hardest chapter to understand in the entire book. And yet I have to tell you this morning, I'm filled with such joy and excitement about some of the things that are here for us in this chapter that we need to pray and ask God to help me contain myself and be clear, because it would be easy just to run off on all kinds of, I think, wonderful tangents. However, since I know that you can't handle a five-hour service, we need to pray that God would help me to keep my thoughts focused this morning. I'd like to read the first 13 verses of this wonderful chapter. This wonderful chapter, beloved, that includes you. This chapter is about us. And once you understand that, perhaps it's not quite so complicated. Then I was given a measuring rod like a staff, and I was told, "Come and measure the temple of God and the altar and those who worship there. But do not measure the court outside the temple. Leave that out, for it is given over to the nations, and they will trample over the holy city for 42 months. And I will grant my two witnesses authority to prophesy for 1,260 days, wearing sackcloth. These are the two olive trees and the two lampstands that stand before the Lord of the earth. And if anyone wants to harm them, fire pours from their mouth and consumes their foes. Anyone who wants to harm them must be killed in this manner. They have authority to shut the sky so that no rain may fall during the days of their prophesying. And they have authority over the waters to turn them into blood and to strike the earth with every kind of plague as often as they desire. When they have finished their testimony, the beast that comes up from the bottomless pit will make war on them and conquer them and kill them. And their dead bodies will lie in the street of the great city that is prophetically called Sodom and Egypt, where also their Lord was crucified. For 3.5 days... members of the peoples and tribes and languages and nations will gaze at their dead bodies and refuse to let them be placed in a tomb. And the inhabitants of the earth will gloat over them and celebrate and exchange presents, because these two prophets had been a torment to the inhabitants of the earth. But after the 3.5 days, the breath of life from God entered them, and they stood on their feet, and those who saw them were terrified. Then they heard a loud voice from heaven saying to them, 'Come up here.' And they went up to heaven in a cloud while their enemies watched them. At that moment, there was a great earthquake, and a tenth of the city fell. 7,000 people were killed in the earthquake, and the rest were terrified and gave glory to the God of heaven." So reads the words of the living God. Last January, the Lord gave me a very sweet and kind providence. While in Southern California, I had the opportunity to meet a man by the name of Erwin Lutzer. Now, that's a name that some of you may recognize. His radio broadcasts play around the country. He is the author of many books. He is the pastor of the historic Moody Memorial Church in Chicago. Well, though up until that time we had not been acquainted, we found ourselves speaking together at the same conference and staying at the same hotel. And so following a few minutes of chit-chat after we had been introduced to one another, Dr. Lutzer said to me, "Why don't we meet together for breakfast for the next 2 days?" And I said, "Sure, that'd be great." And so for an hour, each of those next two mornings, we became friends over fruit and oatmeal. We talked about ministry, we talked about theology, we talked about church history, we talked about preaching. To tell you the truth, he had me in stitches for the majority of those 2 hours because he's such a compelling storyteller. Throughout our conversations, however, there was one distinguishing feature of his personality that impressed itself upon me indelibly. And that is his very evident zeal to make known the gospel to people who are not Christians. And by that, beloved, I mean not the making known of the gospel to groups of people through the means of formal preaching, rather the making known of the gospel to individuals by way of personal conversations. He recited one account after another, gospel opportunities with people on airplanes and next door neighbors and Chicago street people. Never in all of it was there the slightest hint of self-promotion. To the contrary, he seemed almost lost in the joy of recounting these evangelistic experiences. Never once did he turn to me and say, "You know, Art, you should be like this." He didn't have to. That afternoon, as I took my seat on the plane to fly home, I closed my eyes for a moment and said to myself, "Why am I not like that?" And of course, all of the learned justifications quickly appeared on the screen of my mind. I preach the gospel every week. Certainly, for all my obvious deficiencies, the people of Christ Community Church could testify that I love the gospel, that the great delight of my life is to offer it freely to people who are not Christians. I do it nearly every Sunday. But that didn't dull the real issue digging at my conscience. "Well, after all, it is a matter of giftedness, isn't it? It's obvious that Dr. Lutzer has unique evangelistic gifts, gifts that God has not given to me." But again, as I sat there with my eyes closed, attempting to rest, my mind would allow me no respite. "Well, you know, I don't want to be associated with those easy believism kind of folk. People who pressure others into making decisions for Jesus and then counting these spurious conversions like so many scalps." But that too was a pretty thin straw man. So I became a bit more aggressive. "Look at how busy I am. As it is, I rarely get a full day off. I have two young children. I have a terrific load of ministry responsibilities, sermons to plan and services to prepare and articles to write and people to see and meetings to attend and conferences and seminars and fraternals. You know that tune, my friends. It may play in a slightly different key for you, but you may be as adept at playing it as I am." That afternoon on the plane, however, it wouldn't play. I couldn't get it to play. I could hear the West Virginia sentiment of my friend Tom Smith. "That dog won't hunt." And so I asked myself again, why am I not like that? Why am I not more evangelistically proactive in my personal encounters with the people who cross my path? I've thought about it a lot since then. Now, while to be sure the answer is multifaceted, at the very heart of it, I've concluded, is this one explanation. It's because I'm afraid of losing something I value. It's because I fear losing something I value. I think that's a fear that plagues many of us. I think it's a fear that undercuts, undermines, impedes the freeness with which we share the gospel. Because you see, my dear friends, experience very quickly teaches us that the act of making known the gospel to another human being will almost always involve a personal loss of one kind or another. That doing this will nearly always necessitate a sacrifice of something we prize. For example, there are some of you here this morning, I know, who live with the fear that sharing the gospel will mean nothing less than losing your family, losing a spouse, losing friends. Some of you fear the loss of a job. Some of you fear being passed over for advancement in the company. You fear a reduction in your profit margins. In several parts of the world, Christians fear the making known of the gospel will result in the loss of economic security, social stability, the loss of physical safety, even the loss of life itself. I don't know that it's possible to really make known the gospel apart from some experience of personal loss. Now, for many of us here this morning, admittedly, it's a loss of a different kind that we fear. It's the loss of something many of us prize so highly, it borders on idolatry. We fear the loss of dignity. We fear the loss of our image. We dread the loss of our reputation, our status, our esteem in other people's eyes. It's the embarrassment of a wounded pride that we seem to fear most of all. If I openly confess to be a Christian, and moreover, if I actually call someone else to do the same, he may despise me. She'll snicker at me under her breath. He'll avoid me. The other students in my class, the co-workers in my office, the people of my neighborhood, I'll be a topic for their amusement. They'll mock me, even if it's behind my back. I can't take the humiliation. Have you ever felt that way? I certainly have. The fact is, making known the gospel always involves loss. Now, the context in which you make the gospel known will determine the nature of the loss demanded of you, but the plain truth is this, that by virtue of what the gospel is and what the gospel demands, making it known to another person will nearly always require the loss of something you prize. At times, the loss of something that bears great value. And that, beloved, is why this interlude is here. Now, do you remember the setting? Do you remember John's literary design? He follows here a pattern established in the very first series of judgments he introduced. There, if you recall, between the sixth and seventh seal judgments, John inserted a break in the action. An interlude of two parts intended to assure us of the spiritual preservation of God's people. Lest we fear that God's judgments be imprecise, that they're careless, that they're sloppy, John wants Christians to know that God's judgments are always directed by a precision guidance system that, while always destroying the deserving targets, leaves no collateral damage. God's people then need never fear His judgments on the inhabitants of the earth. As it were, God has marked us with a seal so as to guarantee our protection. Remember that wonderful interlude back in chapter 7? Now here we find ourselves at a similar break in the action, not accidentally interposed between the sixth and seventh trumpet judgments. It's an interlude that begins in chapter 10, verse 1, and extends through chapter 11, verse 14. The theme of this interlude, however, is not merely that of preservation. It includes that. It is that of vindication. Don prayed that way this morning. Ultimate vindication, final vindication, eternal vindication. How does this vindication express itself? In two ways made evident in the two parts of this interlude. As we discovered last Lord's Day in chapter 10, verses 1 through 11, God's people, here described in this broad context as witnesses, are vindicated by means of the final judgment of their enemies. It's the answer to the prayer of the martyred Christians back in chapter 6. Remember? How long, O Lord, before you judge and avenge our blood on the inhabitants of the earth? Here then is God's response. There will be no more delay. But in the days when the seventh angel is to blow his trumpet, the mystery of God will be fulfilled as he announced to his servants the prophets. It's God's vindication of his people. His holy and eternal retribution poured out upon those who persecuted His people for their witness to Jesus Christ. You see, beloved, the making known of the gospel involved loss, didn't it? Has it been so long for you since we've considered the Asia Minor Christians? Severed from the trade unions so they could not earn a living. unable to buy or sell in the marketplace so that they couldn't feed their families, thrown into prison, tortured and killed. It was all standard fare, you see. The making known of the gospel involved loss, severe loss. And the point is, it always does. Accept it, beloved, as axiomatic. Come to terms with it. It will help you to admit reality for what it really is, truly is. Be it a loss of something as silly as your dignity or something as significant as life itself. And God, you see, He's not unaware of this. He's not indifferent to it. How long, O Lord? He assures His people that He Himself will vindicate them in the final judgment of their enemies. But, beloved, God's vindication of His people does not merely express itself in judgment. The fact is, His vindication of them infinitely transcends judgment. It not only includes the exercise of the awesomely negative, it also encompasses the experience of the gloriously positive. Now, in the second half of this interlude, God is seen to vindicate His people in a much different way, by a means that imitates God's vindication of Jesus Christ Himself. To state it in a sentence, here in chapter 11, God vindicates His people by means of their ultimate experience of reward. And yet, more focused, more particularly, the point is this. Given the fact that this reward is like unto that experienced by Jesus Christ, the pathway to that reward will prove to be the same pathway He Himself trod. Now let me explain to you what I mean by this. In chapter 11, verses 1 to 13, we see the career of the church of Jesus Christ, expressed in four brief video clips, as it were, that graphically illustrate the road to her ultimate reward. In the first video clip, verses 1 and 2, we're informed of her spiritual protection. In the second video clip, verses 3 through 6, we're told of her invincible witness. In the third video clip, verses 7 through 10, we're alerted to her satanic persecution. And then in the fourth video clip, verses 11 to 13, were made to see her final reward. This is the career of the Church of Jesus Christ, beloved, and whether or not you have ever understood it before now, you must come to terms with it today. This is the Church's pathway to ultimate reward, protected, witnessing, persecuted, vindicated. And there is no other way. Not if we're going to be the church. How did I say it to you last week? Being a follower of Jesus Christ means being a witness to Jesus Christ. Being a witness to Jesus Christ will in some sense mean being a martyr for Jesus Christ. Being a martyr for Jesus Christ will ultimately mean being a victor because of Jesus Christ. Now, all of this will begin to take shape before your very eyes. For this morning, let's just take a look at the first video clip, shall we? It concerns the spiritual protection of the church, the spiritual protection of the people of God. Then I was given a measuring rod like a staff, and I was told, come and measure the temple of God and the altar and those who worship there. But do not measure the court outside the temple. Leave that out, for it is given over to the nations, and they will trample over the holy city for 42 months. Now, friends, this represents something new for us in the outworking of the book of Revelation. Not new in terms of the content of the message, new in terms of its manner of transmission. That is to say, up until this point, John has been a passive observer of these apocalyptic visions, simply recording the sights and sounds of what he sees and hears. Now, however, as we've just read, He's recruited to be an active participant in these visions. What did we see at the end of chapter 10? John is told to take the open scroll in the angel's hand and eat it. In other words, he's now no longer a disengaged reporter, a dispassionate observer. He's become a part of the story itself. And as you well know, this is a common pattern in the Scriptures, is it not? The prophets were frequently called upon to employ symbolic action so as to dramatize their message. Isaiah, for example, was told by God to walk around naked and barefoot so as to symbolize Egypt's impending captivity to Assyria, that they would be stripped of everything, humiliated, and taken into exile. The judgment of God. Ezekiel was told to dig a hole through the wall of the city of Jerusalem, to pack his luggage and to take his luggage through that hole. He was to do this in the sight of all people so as to symbolize their imminent exile into Babylonian captivity. In the book of Acts, we read of a man named Agabus, a prophet who took Paul's belt, bound his hands and his feet so as to symbolize that the apostle would be bound by his enemies in Jerusalem. That, you see, is what's going on right here. John is acting out a pantomime. It's a sermon without words. A symbolic action intended to communicate a specific message. But this now forces the first of many questions upon us. This temple that John is told to measure with this measuring rod, the ancient equivalent of a tape measure, is this a literal temple or is this a symbolic temple? What is John seeing in this apocalyptic vision? Well, some people suggest that this is a literal temple. It's a reference to a literal temple, an actual temple, the actual temple in Jerusalem, they will tell us. But my friends, if this is the literal Jerusalem temple, then only two possible choices exist for the time period in which this scene occurs. Either sometime prior to 70 AD, because by that date the Romans had destroyed the Jerusalem temple, which would also, by the way, require the fact that the revelation had to be written sometime prior to 70 AD. Or, as others have suggested, perhaps the most predominant and popular view in our day, that in fulfillment of the Old Testament prophecy concerning a last day's temple, this here is a literal temple in Jerusalem that has been reconstructed just prior to the time of the return of Jesus Christ, which, of course, we would have to admit right up front, would have no bearing to the Asia Minor Christians. In other words, so such folk say, this is to be understood so literalistically that the current Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem will need to be torn down, the Jewish temple rebuilt on that very site, the priesthood revived, the sacrifices reinstituted. This, they say, is the only right way to interpret the prophecies of the Old Testament, in particular the prophecies of a last day's temple. But beloved, before you make a decision on the best way to approach this, to understand it, let me offer you, please, two vitally important interpretive clues. Firstly, don't read the Old Testament as a document that is self-interpreting. That is to say, let's allow the New Testament to define the fulfillment of the prophecies of the Old Testament. I would remind you, my friends, that the writers of the New Testament were taught to rightly interpret the Old Testament by the resurrected Christ himself. Luke 24. Secondly, rather than reading into this our own sense of what this must mean, let's allow John to interpret himself, okay? Let's see how John uses this language elsewhere. Because Bible study is not the imposition of our subjective convictions upon the text. Look at what I've come up with. Isn't this neat? It's working hard to discern what the author meant by what he said. All of our ideas must yield to his. Now, having said that, to be sure, the Old Testament prophets spoke of a great last day's temple. Most emphatically, the prophet Ezekiel. You can read it in the book that bears his name, beginning in chapter 40. It is the primary text from which this vision is drawn. a great and glorious temple in which God's very presence would be placed. Now, my friends, you can argue the livelong day about literal versus symbolic. What I want to know is this. How did the New Testament writers speak about the fulfillment of this prophecy? Are you following my logic? How did the New Testament writers speak about the fulfillment of this prophecy? It's not for me to determine how it should be fulfilled. And what we discover from the Gospels themselves, beginning at the very outset of the ministry of Jesus, we discover that He Himself is the one who sets us on a trajectory of interpretation. When He says in John 2, "Destroy this temple," looking at that great Herodian palace, "and in 3 days I will raise it up." And John adds, he was speaking of the temple of His body. You know, friends, one of the great burdens of the Gospel of John is to show us how so many of those Old Testament images find their full realization in Jesus Christ. He's the true bread of life, the new manna that has come down out of heaven, John 6. He's the true vine in contrast to the faithless vine of Israel, John 15. And you see there in John chapter 2, this is one of those instances again. Jesus is the last day's temple. He is the ideal temple. What distinguishes the temple? The presence of God in that place. This is now where God dwells. In Emmanuel, God with us, the one in whom, Paul says, all the fullness of the deity dwells bodily. How does the Apostle Paul then build on this? 1 Corinthians 3. "Do you not know that you all," plural, speaking of the church, "do you not know that you are God's temple?" But what is it that defines something to be the temple? The presence of God. So Paul goes on to say, "and that God's Spirit dwells in you," plural. "If anyone destroys God's temple, God will destroy that person, for God's temple is holy, and you are that temple." 2 Corinthians 6, Paul says, "we are the temple of the living God." What is it that marks out the temple of God? The presence of God. So what does Paul do? He goes on in the very next verse to quote God in the fulfillment of that great Old Testament promise, "I will live in them." What marks out the temple of God? The presence of God. Paul says, that's the church. In Ephesians 2, Paul says, "in Christ, the whole structure," temple imagery, "is joined together and grows into a holy temple in the Lord." You say, now wait a minute, Art. There's been a bit of an evolution in what you've said. You said, first of all, that Jesus is the temple. Now you're saying that the church is the temple. Which is it, Jesus or the church? And the answer is yes. When by grace Christians become attached to Christ, we become a part of that last day's temple. And what is it that always distinguishes the presence of God at the temple? The presence of God. And so Paul concludes in Ephesians by saying, "in whom you also are built together spiritually into a dwelling place for God." Let's allow the New Testament to interpret the fulfillment of the prophecies of the Old Testament, shall we? Peter says, "come to Him, Jesus. Attach yourself to Him. A living stone, though rejected by mortals, yet chosen and precious in God's sight. And like living stones, let yourselves be built into a spiritual house, a temple." 28, God's going to build a temple in Zion. And who will be the chief cornerstone? Wrong, Isaiah. A person can't be a chief cornerstone. It can't in this temple. Because it's not made of bricks and mortar, you see. The chief cornerstone in this temple will be Jesus Christ. Therefore, Peter says, attach yourself to Him, and in so doing, along with Him, form the prophesied temple of God. Beloved, you have to be predisposed not to see this. How do the writers of the New Testament define the fulfillment of the Old Testament prophecy concerning the last day's temple, the place where God's presence dwells? The temple, beloved, is the resurrected Christ and all those who are vitally attached to Him by the gift of salvation. In other words, the temple is the church, God's people. And what do we discover then when we come to the Revelation? In chapters 1, 2, and 3, the church is likened to what? Golden lampstands. That's imagery taken from where? The furniture of the temple. The golden lampstand was in the holy place. That's not a symbol chosen randomly, my friends. We're a part of the temple. You remember the promise Jesus Christ made to the overcomers in Philadelphia? I will make you a pillar in the temple of my God. Who would dare suggest that that's to be understood literally? The fact of the matter is, my friends, unless Revelation 11 is the one exception, never anywhere else in the Revelation does John refer to the temple of God as a literal physical building on earth. In fact, how does the book end? With a vision of the new heavens and the new earth. And by the way, where's the temple in the new heavens and the new earth? The place distinguished by God's unique presence? There is no temple. Why? Because now the entire creation is God's temple. In fact, when the angel seeks to measure the new Jerusalem, do you remember this? Another way of referring to the new heaven and the new earth. What is it, the shape of the new Jerusalem? It's a perfect cube. Strange shape for a literal city. There's only one other cube in all the Bible. The Holy of Holies. The place where God put His presence. But you see, beloved, God's purpose was never to keep His presence confined in an itty-bitty little cube. His design was for it to break out of that box and cover the earth. You see, beloved, according to the book of Hebrews, the temple in Jerusalem was never to be regarded as the literal one. It was the figurative one, anticipating what God ultimately designed for the entire creation, a creation that is marked out by His immediate and intimate presence. And so you see, the Old Testament prophecy of that great restored temple began to be fulfilled with the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, and the construction of it expands every time a man or woman, boy or girl, comes to faith in Jesus Christ. The temple is being built. From time to time, people will come to me with little magazine articles from Time Magazine or Newsweek talking about how the Jews are trying to rebuild that literal temple. It's irrelevant to us. The temple is the church. It's being constructed even now. And one day it will span the entire created realm. Let's allow the New Testament to interpret the Old Testament. Let's allow John to interpret himself. You say, but that means that we need to read this temple as something symbolic. I don't like this symbolic business. I don't like this symbolism. It makes me nervous. You know, it's the first step on the slippery slope to liberalism. I mean, if you interpret this symbolically, oh, before you know it, you'll be interpreting Jonah symbolically and the miracle symbolically and then the resurrection of Jesus symbolically, and then we'll lose the gospel. Is there anything in those texts to suggest that they should be taken symbolically? No. So we don't take them symbolically. Is there anything in the Revelation to suggest that we should take it symbolically? The very first verse in the very first chapter. Look at it. Look at it. Chapter 1, verse 1. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave Him to show His servants what must soon take place, He made it known. by sending his angel to his servant John. He made it known. Maybe your translation says, he revealed it. Go home and look up that one Greek verb. You know what it means? Watch now. To communicate by symbols. So why don't you take the revelation literally? Because in the very first verse of the very first chapter, John tells us to take it all symbolically. That's not to deny the historicity of this book, beloved. It's simply a matter of respecting its literary genre. Let's allow John to interpret himself. All right? That's the mother of all introductions. Now go back to chapter 11. Here then, John is told to measure the temple, the altar, and the worshipers. But friends, he doesn't suddenly lapse into the inconsistency of literalism here. This is a broad symbolic representation of God's people. Why characterized as a temple? Because this is where God's presence is. Why an altar and worshipers? To evoke in our minds the primary activity of God's people. We are priests in the presence of God who worship Him. And John is told to measure all of this. You say, well, Art, what's this measuring business? Well, my friends, John here draws upon the imagery of Zechariah chapter 2. And there, an angel measures the city of Jerusalem so as to illustrate the promise of God's protection of it. In other words, carefully measuring it so as to rightly identify what belongs to God. Every single inch of it, so that he might protect it. Measuring with a view to protection. That's the imagery John is drawing upon here. That's what's going on. This measuring implies protection. And this sits so wonderfully with the balance of God's book. You remember the earlier interlude? How did it all begin? A seal of protection is placed on the foreheads of God's servants. Is this a literal seal that someone could see? Can you see mine? I can't see yours. No, it's not a literal seal. Moreover, did this seal exempt its recipients from persecution? No, we hear the cry of the martyrs underneath the altar, remember? That seal, then, was a mark to ensure the spiritual preservation of God's people. And here you see, in the literary symmetry of the revelation, the measuring of this temple is yet another way of illustrating God's protection of His people. Measure them. Identify who's mine. Does this mean, then, that God will preserve His people from physical attack, from physical suffering, from physical oppression, from physical bodily persecution? Well, without considering the text itself, all I need to do is ask you, was Jesus exempt from these things? Or Paul? Peter? These Asia Minor Christians? You're going to be exempt from persecution. Really? The making known of the gospel involved loss. It always does. Watch now, friends, more particularly as this task of measuring is now defined by certain limitations. Look at verse 2. But, contrast, do not measure the court outside the temple. Leave that out. Exclude it. Why? For it is given over to the nations. Who are these nations? Remember chapter 10, verse 11? Last verse, chapter 10. Then they said to me, John, you must prophesy again. And remember the better understanding there of that preposition. Against many peoples and nations and languages and kings. That phrase that from that point on in Revelation always refers to the enemies of God. Who are these nations? The court outside the temple, left over, given over, surrendered to the nations. Who are these nations? Those opposed to God and His people. The enemies of God. Now you get the point of what John's being told. Everything outside the temple, John, belongs to them. It's surrendered to them. It's their domain. Exclude them from this measuring. They're not to be protected. To the contrary, John, they're the reason I will protect my people. Look at what he says. And they will trample over the holy city for 42 months. You say, what's this holy city? Are we going to allow John to interpret himself? In the Revelation, what's the holy city? The New Jerusalem. So what's the New Jerusalem? Are we going to let John interpret himself? John 21 tells us that the New Jerusalem is the bride adorned for her husband. So what you're saying, Hart, if I'm following you, is that here the temple refers to the people of God and the holy city refers to the people of God? Yes. It's the thing that we've seen in the Revelation over and over and over and over again. One referent designated by multiple symbols. Remember chapter 5? Jesus is the lion from the tribe of Judah. And in the very next verse, what? The slaughtered lamb. One referent designated by multiple symbols. Remember the first interlude? The people of God are symbolized as Israel fulfilled. 144,000 from each of the 12 tribes. And in the very next passage, an innumerable multitude of international worshipers. One referent designated by multiple symbols. Welcome to the world of apocalyptic. What will we see when we finally arrive at the climax of this book? The new heavens and the new earth. The new Jerusalem. The new heavens and the new earth. The new Jerusalem. Now friends, it is not that there is a new heavens and a new earth, and that somewhere in this new heavens and the new earth there is a city, the new Jerusalem. No, John is looking at the same thing from various vantage points. From the perspective of the new heaven and the new earth, it's a renovated universe. From the perspective of the new Jerusalem, it's a community of people. A city, same referent, designated by multiple symbols. And that's what we have right here. The holy city is another way of referring to the temple, the people of God. And you'll notice then that John says that the nations will trample over the holy city. It's a metaphorical way of saying that the nations will mistreat God's people. The nations will abuse God's people. The nations will severely harm God's people with a view to destructive intention. The nations will trample them down. Which is why God graphically illustrates His spiritual protection of them in the prior verse. You see the point, beloved? Why is God intending to protect His people? Because for their totality of their existence as the church, they will meet with persecution. We are not exempt from persecution. We are not raptured from tribulation. We are not delivered from attack. To the contrary, my friends, the unbelieving world will always seek to destroy the church. How is it that Paul said it in Romans chapter 8? For your sake, we are being killed all day long. We are accounted as sheep to be slaughtered. You say, Hart, I thought we were rescued from all of that. Well, my friends, not rescued from suffering and martyrdom. No, Paul tells us in Romans chapter 8 that we're rescued through suffering and martyrdom. The assurance that Paul gives to us, you see, is not that we will be delivered from hardship, distress, persecution, famine, nakedness, peril, or sword. No, Paul says we live with that stuff. What we're assured of is, none of that will ever separate us from the love of God in Christ. You say, well, Art, at least this persecution here that he mentions, it's limited in time. It says that it will occur for 42 months. And there are limits to this time, to be sure. But again, before I explain this to you, at the most basic level, I can ask you, are we to take this number literally in the book? Well, all of the other numbers are to be taken figuratively. The seven spirits of God? The 144,000 saints? The size of the New Jerusalem being 12,000 times 12,000 times 12,000? I don't think so. Let me tell you what this is. Very simple, really. In every period of human history, there are things and events that serve to stand out in everybody's mind. Some of you here this morning are old enough to appreciate this question. Can you remember where you were when you heard that President Kennedy was shot? It became a defining moment for everyone who lived through it. So that now all anyone has to do is make a brief allusion to it. November 63, Dallas. And nothing else needs to be said. All the emotions come flooding back. You remember where you were, who you were with, what you were doing? 47 years ago, our forefathers, Lincoln, Gettysburg, Civil War. It was a defining moment. One small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. Moonwalk, 1969, Neil Armstrong. I can remember where I was when I saw it. It was a defining moment in American history. Now, of course, to someone outside the United States, these are cultural symbols that may have no meaning, that arouse no emotion. They have no point of contact. It's not that such people are dumb or they're unfeeling. It's that those things are not a part of their cultural baggage. And that is precisely what this is. One of the defining moments in Jewish history is the Maccabean Revolt. At the close of the Old Testament, if you recall, the ruling power in the world, as it was then known, was the Medo-Persian Empire. By and by, that empire is overrun by Alexander the Great and the Greeks. When he dies, his empire is divided up into four parts, one of which becomes known as the Seleucid Dynasty. And by, a leader emerges of the Seleucids who was named Antiochus Epiphanes. He was a most passionate pagan. He made it a capital offense for a Jew to own a portion of the Hebrew Bible, to observe any kind of religious rite, including the Sabbath. He entered into Jerusalem, invaded the temple, sacrificed pigs on the altar, dedicated the whole thing to a pagan god. It was a time of great butchery. It was a dark and depressed time for the people of Israel. That was 167 BC. But under the leadership of a man known as Judas the Hammer, Judas Maccabeus, an incessant barrage of guerrilla warfare began, and finally, amazingly, Antiochus was beaten. It was an astounding triumph. The whole thing lasted 3.5 years, and it proved to be a defining moment in Jewish history. It became a part of their self-identity. Even secular Jews today can speak to you of that moment in their history. That's what they celebrated, Hanukkah. How much more must have this been the case in the first century, given the fact that it was so much closer in time? And so you can see, beloved, then, that this idea of 3.5 years, 1260 days, 42 months, or time, times, and half a time, these designations that now begin to appear in the Revelation, each referring to the same time period, came to be used as symbolic representations of a period of extreme suffering that would be brought to an end before its intended conclusion. Understand this in the context of all the sevens in Revelation. Stressing completion, 3.5 is a broken seven. It is a period of great severity suddenly brought to an end. A time of persecution, a time of oppression, a time of tribulation. And what has John already told us in the very first chapter of this book? That we are now living in this time. It is the time of sustained tribulation between the two advents of Jesus Christ. In fact, beloved, though we will consider it more carefully next week, take note of verse 3. In particular, notice the activity that's mentioned and the length of time for which it is to be exercised. And I will grant my two witnesses authority to prophesy for 1,260 days. Even I can do the math here. 42 months at 30 days a month, according to Hebrew reckoning, 1,260 days. You get the point? Can you connect the dots between verse 2 and verse 3? For the same period of time that God's people are given the responsibility to witness this present time between the two comings of Jesus Christ, they will relentlessly live with persecution, with opposition, with martyrdom. There is no escaping this, beloved. And this, you see, is why God wants us to be certain of our spiritual protection corresponding to these days of witness. Witness that is met with opposition. Making known the gospel will involve loss. Acknowledge it. Embrace it. I don't see that there's any other way to become vigilant in our witness until we acknowledge that this is how it will be. If we wait for a context that will assure us of not losing anything, we'll miss every opportunity under the sun that comes our way. This is what goes with the deal, beloved. This is the road that Jesus trod. It will involve loss, loss of dignity, loss of family, loss of friends, loss of employment, loss of money, loss of life. There's no getting around it. Our confidence is grounded in this. God has measured us. We are protected by Him. And that ultimately and finally, as we will soon see, He will reward us in the same way He rewarded His own Son. You know how Revelation 14 defines Christians? I love it. They follow the Lamb wherever He goes. Do we take that literally? First we go to Bethlehem, then to Nazareth, then to Jerusalem. No, don't be silly. It means that His true followers are defined as those who walk the pathway Jesus Himself trod. Ultimate reward by way of a faithful witness that perseveres through suffering. All the while taking confidence in the fact that God Himself protects us. Beloved, this is the career of the church. This is the pathway of the church. Please, expunge your mind of anything other than that. Are you a part of this temple? Are you a witness for the gospel? Have you known something of this opposition? Being a follower of Jesus Christ means being a witness to Jesus Christ. Being a witness to Jesus Christ will in some sense mean being a martyr for Jesus Christ. Being a martyr for Jesus Christ will ultimately mean being a victor because of Jesus Christ. John states it much more simply. A true Christian follows the Lamb wherever He goes. Would you bow your heads with me, please? God's desire, my friends, is not simply that you would be a hearer of the Word, but a doer of it. A lot's been said this morning, I know. Would you take a moment to consider what it is that God wants you to do with what you've heard?